Thank you. Thank you. Please ask me any questions. However, I have some answers for the mathematicians in the room. Smooth enough, fast enough, and yes, completely, it always works, it's general. Okay, so. So I have three things to say. I want to first remind you or educate you about knots and links. I got to look at some of the lectures this morning, and I realized really I should back up and talk about knots and links a little bit, and I should talk about topological defects in condensed matter systems, or just in general. And then, of course, the whole point of this workshop is merging these two ideas together to get knotted fields. Knotted fields, some people might make a distinction between knotted fields and knotted flows. That just depends on what dimension you think you're living in. So let's start, right, with the mathematician who did everything, Gauss, right? And Gauss considered the following question. How can you calculate if these two loops are linked? Oh my gosh, I forgot something. I'll be right back. I forgot my loops. In the meantime, can somebody do a floor show? Actually, can you get my loops? They're on my desk. Thanks. That'll be easier. So how do you decide if these things are looped together? Well, let's borrow from Maxwell, because everybody's supposed to know Maxwell. And in fact, it's interesting, even though Gauss did this, let's see, 1833, I'm going to use Maxwell's equations. I don't need that. Okay, I'm going to use Maxwell's equations to talk about how to calculate the linking number. And Maxwell, of course, was later than Gauss. But apparently Maxwell was a big fan of reading about that. So he was probably inspired by this. So imagine you have the two curves, gamma 1. I'm sorry that there's math, but this is the only math. My pal Charlie Epstein back at Penn would say this is just calculus. This is advanced calculus. There's no math here. So here's these two curves, gamma 1 and gamma 2. And I can calculate, oh, thanks very much. I can calculate the winding of these by thinking that gamma 2 has some current going through it. And I remember one of those guys' laws, Ampere's law, I think, that if I integrate B dot dr1 around gamma 1, this closed line integral, it tells me how much current goes through. You know, it's like the flux. So it will tell me here's the current, I going through there, and n is the number of times this loop goes through there. So it might not go through at all. If the loop of current doesn't go through the loop I'm interested in, I get nothing. So there you go, the integral of B dot dr is n, but then I can use the Biot-Savart law, which I'll remind you, you also learned, which is dr2 cross. All right, so there I can calculate the magnetic field that arises from loop 2. This is gamma 2, like so. And I can put these two things together to deduce what Gauss deduced, that if I want to know the linking number between two curves, or gamma 1 and gamma 2, what do? I just put these two equations together. And I get an integral dr1 plus dr2. And the beauty of this is, I set the current equal to 1, because I use units where the current is 1. And there I get the linking number. And this integral, which looks icky, is actually an integer. Right? I have to put the 4 pi's, you know, I have to put mu naught and epsilon naught, whatever those things are, those are important. There's probably an r over 4 pi. I don't care. Okay? All right, all that matters is that complicated thing is an integer, because it's just kind of the linking number. But how did Gauss do it? Because he didn't know Maxwell's equation. He probably did. Okay. Gauss did it in a much cleverer way and more germane to what we're doing. He said, look, you have this curve, R1 of S, and you have this other curve, R2 of T. See those two curves? They never touch, right? Because they're linked or not linked. I'm never going to allow the two curves to touch. So I can make a new vector, N, which is just the difference of the two. And because they never touch, I can normalize it. So now I have a unit vector, N, that depends only on S and T. What does that mean? S is some coordinate that goes from 0 to 2 pi around curve 1, and T is some coordinate that goes from 0 to 2 pi around curve 2. And now we're all set because what do? I integrate, it turns out, N dot ds cross dtn, integrated ds1, ds2. What am I doing? Well, you geometric people will recognize what this object is. If I have a sphere, and here's the unit vector n, this is a little patch of area dsn dtn big. I have a little square patch. So this is just the area that the normal sweeps out on this unit sphere. And so I'm just counting how many times the vector that's living on what? On what shape? It's living on the torus. Why is it a torus? Can anyone see it's a torus? I'll ask the question. Do you see why it's a torus? Because one coordinate, S, goes around this way from 0 to 2 pi, and the other coordinate, T, goes around this way from 0 to 2 pi. So here's one coordinate, T, and there's the other coordinate, S. And now I've shown you that for every point on this torus, I have a vector N of S and T, a unit vector, and it lives on the sphere. And this is the area that that thing sweeps out on the sphere. And it's also an integer, because either I sweep out no times, or one time, or two times. Again, there's that 1 over 4 pi. Okay? And that's how Gauss did it. But I didn't tell you this because I wanted to tell you how clever Gauss was. I wanted to tell you this to now talk about the idea of having maps from T2, the torus, to the sphere. Right? And in general, what I've now done is I've made a way of calculating how many times this map covers that map. I could do something really boring, and that's I think mathematicians use the word trivial for boring. I could say every point on this torus goes to the North Pole. Okay? Every point on this thing I map to the North Pole. That would be boring. Instead, I managed to somehow take this torus and wrap it around the sphere. Maybe I can wrap it once or twice or three times. And the number of times I do it tells me about the degree of the map. So this Gauss linking number is actually a way of counting something about how many times something goes around on a sphere.
And that's called the second fundamental group, or the second homotopy group. And I'm going to explain in more detail what that means.
But I need to ask any questions now, or you need to ask any questions now. Is it clear what I'm saying? I'm going to calculate the linking number. The linking number is a road, or a route, to calculating integers that have to do with maps from this object to this object. Okay. Rob already looks unhappy. Okay. So I have these rings here. And you understand that rings, right? These rings can't, I can't do stuff with the rings. So, you know, right? You ready? Are you watching?
I'm watching.
See how they're linked now? Thank you. And if you are okay watching? All right. Okay, so you can unlink them. All right. Here, so here. Why don't you try? Go ahead. No, Grant, let go. Okay. Try to link them.
No, I can't.
Try. That's the best you can do? Here, look, it's easy. Unlink those. Okay? Try and link those.
Okay.
So, This seems all natural to you, right? But this is all this is, all right? We've just explored everything that Gauss did. We're now caught up to 1833, the entire content of topology up until 1833 we've just done, demonstrated right now. So, if there's a second homotopy group, there must be a first homotopy group. It's one of those things that they tell you at Passover, I always think, right? Why do we dip twice when usually we don't dip once? So if there's a second homotopy group, there must be a first homotopy group. But we already talked about it right here. And I'll remind you what it is, if you don't know.
I have a current. There's a current. And then I do some integral, right, around some curve. I can integrate B dot dl around that curve. And it tells me how much current flows through there. And if I always have current coming in integer amounts of current, which apparently I do if I think of that current line as another line, another thing that I'm linking, then if n is an integer, then I can count and I can say, does one flux line go through, one line of current go through, or two lines of current, or three lines of current go through, and that gives me some classes or some classification based on loops. Here's a classification based on loops. Here's a classification based on spheres. Right? So I have loops and I have spheres, and this classification is called the fundamental group, pi 1 of something. And to make it really precise, let me think about a knot. So I have a knot right here. Of course, right, so this is also called an unknot. This is a knot, even though it's nothing, it's an unknot. Okay, and you can take it apart, you can give it a twist, and relink it in there. Does anyone know what this one is called? This knot, you know this knot's name? Trefoil, right, because I did it once, see the trefoil knot, you see it? Right, and you can take two twists, right, and do it, and then you get the figure eight knot. Okay? And you can keep going like that. You can do it three times. It's called the three-twist knot. They ran out of names. Okay? And so the knot is an interesting thing because the knot itself is just a piece of rope. So how do you study knots? What you do is you look at space. Here's space. Here's all of space. And here's your knot. Here, it's just a closed loop now. Right? So here... here's this closed loop, like so. Here it is. And now you ask yourself, suppose you're way back there, you're sitting where Marcus is sitting. You ask, what happens? Suppose I take a walk, and I walk from where Marcus is, and I walk over here, and then I walk back. Well, I can only do two things. When you walk from here to there, you can either not go through this loop and come back, or go through the loop and come back. Agreed? Or I could go twice or three times. So I can classify the knot by talking about the fundamental group, the space of paths that go from where Marcus is sitting to the knot and back. Okay, so there's some long thread. I have your assistance here. We've never met. Okay, right? And so here I'm here, and it goes like this. All right, there I could loop once, or I could loop twice, right? And I can go back. I could decide to go around. Dogs are good at this, right? And so when I do that, I can get a representation of the knot. I'm not actually looking at the knot. I'm looking at what's not the knot, right? This is not the knot, okay? Or it's the outside of the bagel, okay? It's the rest of the bagel, right? It's the thing that the coffee goes around when you dunk a donut, all right? It's not the knot. But then if you have more complicated knots, this question of what happens when you take these paths become more complicated. So the way you talk about knots, or a way of talking about knots, is to take the space. Now, what space do you think this is living in? Anyone? Not the mathematicians. They're not allowed to talk, apparently.
R3.
You say R3. No, here. Somebody say R2. It's R3. Okay. The problem with R3 is the problem that my dad brought up. My father took physics when he was in City College. He took physics, and they always had this problem about bringing an electron from infinity. right? But it was in Brooklyn, right? Or it was in Manhattan. He thought, surely there are closer electrons, right? Right? And so the thing is that I don't want to have anything off at infinity. I don't want to hide anything off infinity. I don't want to hide some part of the knot there. So I always want to take a space which is compact. So you can, the way of making it compact is instead you study S3. You study the three-dimensional sphere, which is the surface of a four-dimensional ball. And of course, locally it looks like R3, but there's this thing where you've closed it back together on itself. It's like taking the complex plane, right, and using stereographic projection to map the sphere in the complex plane, and the point of infinity is the North Pole. So that's just a technical point. So you take the knot, you call it K, and you subtract. And now I'll never forget how long it took me to understand what this symbol meant, right? In math paper. We look, we went to Wikipedia. You try Googling this symbol. It's very difficult. It comes up in tech. It's even hard to tech.
It's hard to tech.
Yeah, it's right. Okay. So minus, okay, but you know, so it's S3 with the knot removed. That's the space, and you're looking at the homotopy of that space, and that's how you study the knots. Okay, and so let's see, there was Helmholtz, there was Kelvin, who was from Northern Ireland, not Scotland.
Peter Cuffy.
Yes, well, Tate's the big hero, right? Because Maxwell was studying Gauss's papers because he was interested in Tate's experiments on smoke rings. Okay? And then later on, Tate made this table, which you've all seen, right? Cheryl will show you. Have you shown this? Where is it? Have you shown me a table?
No.
It's a table. There's all these squiggles.
Okay, and there's a lot of people on mine.
Right? There's the table of squiggles. Okay? This is all that you see when you look at the table of squiggles. Right? There's lots of squiggles. Okay? It's a table of all the knots. And the table is in completely random order. There's nothing meaningful to the labels of the knots, right? Red Miller will tell you later this week, or can tell you sometime, how you can maybe make some sense of the order of the knots here. Right? But there are different knots. There's the 3-1 I showed you and the 4-1 knot. And I didn't show you the 5-1 knot. I showed you the 5-2 knot, or at least I made reference to it. That's the 3-twist knot, and so on. And so there's a bunch of knots here, and Tate made these table of knots. And like David said, this is a failed attempt to understand the world in terms of atoms and molecules as knots in some kind of ether. So, that's it for knots. Are there any questions?
What does homotopy mean?
I don't know. You mean, what does the word mean? It means that when I take this path, that's a good question. And it's easier than the other question, which is, what does homology mean? I don't know what that means at all, right? It means, so here, you hold that. We've never met before either, okay? So I have this rope here, right? And the point is, when I look at this path, I don't care about any details of this path. All I care about is it up to homotopy. I only care about the path up to anything I do, wiggling, as long as it's caught. Okay, as long as these two things don't pass through each other. Beef and go. Okay. All right. So does that make sense? Okay, so homotopy is a smooth deformation that doesn't, it's almost tautological, that doesn't change the topology.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that accurate? Okay. All right, thank you. Okay.
I also have the answer, sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know. So that was knots and links, and it's kind of cool, and it's kind of pretty, and you can tie your shoes with it, and you can do other things. You can do, we saw last night on the pier, you can buy a little tripod that's made out of knots and links. So why is it interesting to us? And you could ask another question, which is, why knots now? Okay. So why knots now? Is because people can make them now, all right? People can take defects, and you'll hear about this on Wednesday at the colloquium. They can actually take light. They can look at nodes in light. The nodal lines in light are topological defects. I'll explain that in a minute. And those nodes in light can be knotted. People can take knots lines of defects in liquid crystals, and not them as well, right? This is all in the past 3 years, all right, 3 or 4 years. So you can do it in light, you can do it in liquid crystals. I don't mean that you find it, I mean that you can actually manipulate it. And even more exciting, about 6 years ago, people discovered the so-called biaxial pneumatic, which people have talked about for, I don't know, 42 years. But now finally somebody found an example of it. And this is another system where the topological defects are interesting. And it could be manipulated. So why not now? Because now we can do something. It's only now that we can do it. So all this topology has been known for ages. It was thrown out when they discovered there was no ether. And now we get to use it because we have ether, we have these fields. So, topological defects. What do I have to say? Well, suppose when I did that line integral, b dot dl, and I said it was equal to n. Remember that? Well, suppose there were no current. Can I do it without any current? I could. No, you say I get zero, right? Well, suppose I tell you that I'm looking down from the top, right? This is the xy plane. Here's the current coming out like this. Suppose I do this path. I integrate around this path. What do I get when I integrate around that path? Good question and answer. Okay. Right? What do I get?
Zero.
Zero, excellent. Now if I integrate around the purple path, what do I get? One. Okay, so if I integrate around the purple path, I get one. But suppose that this was just a point, a single point, right? So the current was all concentrated on a single point. Then you'd have to agree that if I avoid any path that circles that point, then the integral of b dot dl will always be zero. So that makes you think, oh, it's like a conservative force. B must be the gradient of something, because if I go back where I started. My dad also didn't like physics because of that. He thought, if you loaded up a truck and unloaded the truck, then you've done work. There's obviously something wrong. We want to go to infinity. Okay, so this suggests that B is the gradient of something, right? Away from the current. So that's cool, because what it tells you is that it's the gradient of something, and then you get this funny condition here that on this purple curve, the integral of the gradient of something around the closed curve is not zero. And that's okay. The way you deal with that is you say, oh, well, there's something here. I can't use Stokes' theorem or Gauss's law, whatever you want to call it, integration by parts, right, to reduce this to an integral through the surface. Usually you do that by saying this is the curl of the gradient of something, because there's a hole in the surface right here. There's a place where something's not smooth. So I poke a hole, and I call that the defect. There's a place, if you like, where I don't know what the angle is, or I can't define its gradient properly. So I poke a hole in the sample. You can do that if they're liquid crystals, right? So liquid crystals, people will know there's the pneumatic liquid crystal, like so, which is rods. This is in two dimensions, like so. So here you have it in two dimensions, and one thing that can happen is I can have a place where the molecules all rotate, they swirl around this particular point. And that's a defect too. The molecules don't know which way to point. So here's a place where I have to poke a hole in the sample. If you're fancy, you say the order parameter vanishes there, and that's how I deal with it. But I'll just say I poke a hole in the sample. So I poked a hole in the sample, and now I get some kind of winding of the director field. And again, it's quantized in integer amounts. That amounts to saying that this is an angle. So it's not just, if I want to have topological defects, say, in a pneumatic, I could write n as cosine phi, sine phi, like so. Now it's a unit vector, and phi is an angle. So now when I integrate grad phi around a closed curve, it has to come back to itself mod 2 pi. because then the unit vector, this vector, is still single valued. The topological defects are quantized.
They're quantized. And because they're quantized in integer units,
it means that they can't change under homotopy. Because if I change something smoothly, and I have this integral that's an integer, well, the only smoothly varying function that's an integer is a constant. Right? So it must be constant. So no matter what happens when I do dynamics, when anything evolves in time, right, the charge is fixed. It can't change. Okay? So that's what a topological defect is. Now, what's the dream? So I guess it could be, you could call it Helmholtz's dream or Kelvin's dream or Kostowitz and Thallus's dream or the dream of many people, which is, can the defects, be the fundamental degrees of freedom? Can they?
Sure.
Who said sure? Yes?
The guy said sure.
Okay, give me an example. Somebody, anybody give me an example.
Kostowitz-Thallus.
Kostowitz-Thallus, that's an example where it appears to be true. Anyone else? What's he saying?
Smectic.
What?
Emmetic to smectic.
Yeah, you keep saying, you're saying the same thing over and over again. Give me another one. You know, Coulomb gas, it's the same one. Kinks. Kinks in the Stein-Gordon equation are apparently fundamental objects, they're fermions in some other language, so that's kind of cool, right? Can the defects themselves be the fundamental degrees of freedom? So you said the X1 model.
Whenever you're at the lower critical dimension.
Is that true?
Maybe.
Okay, so it's a guess. All right, so that'd be really cool, and it is true that if you go back to, I don't know, early 70s, Kostowitz and Thallus made the following brilliant statement or brilliant observation. If you have a defect, then you can calculate the energy. The energy of a defect in 2D goes like log of the box that you put the system in, log of the size of the box. But the entropy also goes like log of R, because it goes like log of the area, the number of places you can put things. So there must be some temperature where the energy and the entropy swap importance. I write down the free energy, E minus TS. There's a log R out in front, and then there's some number, A minus T. I can call it T, KT minus T. And apparently there's some magic temperature where suddenly you like having defects. Above the temperature, there's an infinite energy when the system size goes to infinity, right? Below TKT, the energy cost of putting a defect in is infinite, and then suddenly below TKT, the energy cost is negative, and they fill the sample, and you have defects everywhere. What? Am I, Bob, thank you.
Well, there's many examples beyond three dimensions.
Yeah, there's three dimensions. You can map superfluids to superconductors.
And in the effect of low-energy field theory of QCD, proton is a defect.
Is proton is a defect? It's a skirmion. Okay. So that's cool, if true, right? If true, would it be great that you can think of these things as the fundamental objects? And in fact, when you all take statistical mechanics, or when you should have taken statistical mechanics, you learn that the Kostowitz-Thallus transition can be completely understood in terms of the defects. In fact, you can look at a system like this of pneumatics and look at the defects. You can calculate the energy exactly just by knowing where the defects are. Just by knowing the charge of the defects and the locations, you can calculate the energy exactly. If you know the energy exactly, you can calculate the partition function. The great thing is the things they interact, like charges, like Coulomb's law, they interact in Coulomb's law, they add and subtract just like charges. You say, wow, this is great, it's like there are charges. And that's all you're left with when you take a course like that. Right? And nobody tells you this is the special case. Right? The special case is when you can do this. Most of the time, you can't do this. Most of the time, just knowing the locations of the defects isn't enough. You have to know something else about them. By the way, just I have a history point, which is, let's see, I wrote it down. You know the first time I heard you speak? You remember? Remember me in the audience? Yeah, you were speaking. No, I didn't. You were speaking at USC, and you were talking about your work with Paul Mende on summing string theory, showing that it violated the somebody's theorem, somebody's result about analyticity, a large S. I remember I went to my political science teacher and said, "I'm not going to go to your class today because I'm going to go to USC and hear this seminar." Remember this? And there, you use Coulomb gas methods to actually solve the same problem. So even our illustrious director has exploited the X-Y model and this fact that when we study these problems, you can treat them like charges. So now the question is it always true? And that's what the knotted fields are about. So, let's see. Robin gave some other examples. He said the smectic to pneumatic transition. Can I go from two dimensions to three dimensions? And the answer is yes, most of the time. Here's my three-dimensional sample, like so. And I could have lines like this. They could have loops like this. This could be a superfluid. Remember, in a superfluid, I have some complex scalar, which has a magnitude and a phase. The phase now is the same object. The phase. The sameness, the fancy way of saying this is that this object lives on the circle, which you call S1. And when I take measuring circuits around one of these things, I'm calculating a map. It's a map from this circle, the purple circle, to the phase angle, which is another circle. All right, so it's a map from the purple circle, to the white circle. Maps like that are called pi1. Pi1 for this circle, of S1 for this circle. This one is the mean that's a circle. That's the fundamental group. So you can talk about maps in a superfluid. Some people think that smectics are the same kind of thing. I guess I think that smectics are the same kind of thing. All right, so let me remind you what a smectic is. A smectic is a system with layers, like so. It's a layered system. It has an order parameter psi. The only thing that's funny about it is instead of just having this phase, it's a phase attached to a background oscillation. So I have these layers. That's phi equals zero. And then I can talk about deformations of the layers, and there's that phase field. And that phase field is just like this phase field. And again, you can talk about defects in the smectic. They're called dislocations. I can't possibly draw them. It's not true. I can draw one of them. I can draw an edge dislocation, like so. Let me draw it from the side, where the layers, I insert an extra layer, like so. And this is an edge dislocation. They don't have this here because UCSB is a modern campus. But they have it in Bristol. They have in lots of places where they have a five-story building attached to a four-story building, right? This is a post-war and pre-war, right? You could have another dislocation. After World War III, you could have another one, right, where you get an extra defect. But right now, you have a four-story building attached to a five-story building, and they call this the mezzanine because they don't know what to label it, right? But you can see that if you start on the first floor, you can go up to the fourth floor, you can go down. And if you come back in what you think is a complete circle, four flights up, four flights down, you'll end up in the wrong place. You'll be dislocated, right? And that's called a dislocation. Okay, and again, that's just a fault in the phase. The phase goes around by some integer multiple of 2 pi, and that gets you off a different floor. And there's a place here, and you don't know what floor you're on. More interesting is a screw dislocation. Who's ever seen a screw dislocation? You've seen one? Come on, in parking lots, right? You know those parking garages? Who's ever been in a parking garage? Right? Parking garage, right? And there's the ramp up and the ramp down, and then there's the part here which connects the up and the down. And you never know what floor you're on, right? Am I on the fifth floor or the fourth floor, right? And that's because where the two floors meet on that angle, you don't know what floor you're on. That's another dislocation. Most parking garages have three dislocations. There's the one at the elevator bank, there's the one at the stairs, and then there's one in the middle for the quick escape. Right? Okay, so you've all seen dislocations. All right. And so all of these are systems where, in some sense, people believe that you can talk about this dream where you replace the fundamental degrees of freedom, the fluctuating smooth parts that you don't care about because you're ignoring things up to smooth deformations, and all you care about is these defects. Okay? So, what's the problem with that? You have a problem? Is there a problem with that? Here, I have a demonstration. Fine. Okay. The problem is that these are just zeros of a field. Right? These are places where the order parameter vanishes, right? So there's nothing topological about it. Right? They can link, and I'm like, it's amazing how big this hole is, right? Okay, here, now you try. Okay, so you just start like, right? Okay. So, you have. I'm probably now going to be arrested by magicians. Right? So the thing is that zeros are not real things. I saw this talk by Kurt where he said, I can't remember what color he used, right? But you drew this. Right? These two things are not equal. Didn't you draw that?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. For polymers, right? But for zeros of a field, right, who cares? Zeros of a field can pass through each other. They're not really linked or unlinked, okay? There's an energetic barrier moving a defect through another defect, but it's not topological. But that's okay, we're still interested in that, right? We're interested now in the idea that it's not just the knots that are there, but it's the field around the knots. And the field around the knots knows about the zeros. It is like a complex function. Right? If I tell you the poles and the branch cuts, you know things about the function somewhere else. And the function, without knowing the poles or the branch cuts, if there's a pole here, I can deduce the presence and strength of the pole by doing something way out here. Right? So it's not just encoded in the fact that I have a piece of thread. It's not just a knot. Oh man, it's linked. Right? It's not just a knot that I've tied in a piece of string, right, and plunged into, you know, wax or the ocean or something. It's a knot that actually has a field around it. It has some set of boundary conditions. And so the field around it actually encodes the information in the knot too. You could get the knot information. After all, that experiment that Marcus was going to do of taking these wonks, right? So look, now I have this knot here. Now you do the wonk. Now, instead of talking about the linking with a real physical object, because it's just a zero of field, now you're going to talk about the phase you pick up as you go from here and back. Because there's a phase, a winding around each of these lines. Right? So now we connect the idea of the knot, which is paths that get trapped on the yellow line, to this phase you pick up in the space of ground states of the background field. So, does everyone get that? Get it? Okay. So, what we want to study is knotted fields. And something that Mark pointed out, which I think is really cool, is that all of these knots that I've been talking about, I can't draw knots. Let's see, I do this. Is anyone going to help me? What do I do next, Redmond? What? I want to draw the trefoil knot. Okay, there, it's some kind of knot. I've hidden everything in here. Okay, so you have some kind of trefoil knot thing, right? And you have your knot, and it has this field around it, but this is a very special field. When the field is the field that I talked about here in a superconductor, right? Or some people call it the XY model, or a two-dimensional pneumatic. Or a smectic. There's something very special. As I go around any of these loops, right, the phase changes by 2 pi, right? If I take a path. Well, those aren't any kind of knots. What can I do? If I have a knot that has it so that when I go around, there's an angle that changes by 2 pi, I can do something called, I can fiber the knot. And what I can do is I can take a surface. I can take a surface of constant phase. So I can take the surface when the phase is pi over 7. Another one would pi over 14. And I'll get a surface. And you have to agree that the surface where it's pi over 7 will never intersect the surface where it's pi over 14. Because they can't, except in one place. On the knot. Because on the knot, I don't know what the phase is. They all end on the knot. Right? If I looked at it from front on, edge on, here's the knot coming out at you. Right? Here's the surface, phi equals 0. Here's phi equals pi over 7. Right? Here's phi equals pi over 2. And so on. So I can draw all these surfaces, right, that all end on this knot. And if this is the only thing there, if it's the only object there with this singularity, then the surfaces have to end on the knot too. So I have a surface that captures, that covers the knot, or that ends on the knot, is bounded by the knot, and I have a whole family of them from 0 to 2 pi. And those are called fibered knots. Okay. So here's the first interesting question that I think we need to address in our program. So this, the trefoil, is a fibered knot. You can fiber it. And, oops, okay. And this, the figure eight knot, is a fibered knot, and you can fiber it. But the three twist knot is not. So the three twist knot, which doesn't look very much different from the two twist knot, the figure eight knot, can't be fibered. So I asked, how would it know? Suppose I had a figure eight knot and I went over here and gave it an extra twist, and insert an extra twist way over here.
What's, what do you mean by the mathematical statement can't be fibered?
It means that there's an obstruction. Maybe Mark knows better what it means. You cannot draw a set of surfaces labeled from 0 to 2 pi that don't intersect themselves that have this knot as the boundary. You can draw a surface, the cipher surface, but you can't draw a whole family of surfaces that go around. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah.
And this one can't be fibered. I don't know how they prove it, but they can prove it, all right? Its Alexander polynomial isn't monic or something like that, okay? That's not helpful to me, right? But it is helpful to me to know that you can't do it. So it means that if you had a figure eight knot and you tried to insert this twist way over here, so you had a very, very long knot, right? A very, very long knot, like, right? You have a very, very long knot, and you've already put some knot into it. Let's see. Right, so, 1, 2. I feel like those guys who make noodles. Because that's an important thing for knot theory, too. Right? You take this knot, and way over here, and now you insert this extra twist. What happens? What happens to the field? The field will not allow it. Okay, the field will say, I will not allow this. So what happens? Does it tell me, does something happen locally? Does it break off? Does it pinch off? It is impossible to have a field with an S1 value in the outside of the knot. So if I look at the knot complement, and I say everywhere inside the knot complement, there's psi has some value, a single value. So there are no other defects. It's impossible, because if I could put a phase field everywhere continuously, then I could fiber the knot. Because the level sets of phi would give me the fibration.
That field would have to have some other defect.
Either it would have a defect, or maybe when you tried to put the twist in, the knot would break into two knots that are okay. Right? It might break up into two. It might, right? You may force another defect. You might, what Mark might suggest is that as you try to twist it, suddenly you'll have a thread that appears through the center of one of the other ones. But in other words, you'll add a new defect, right, somewhere else. And so to me, that's interesting because now a knotted field is different than just the knots. I can't go nicely, even though they're close in the knot table and they're close in name, the three-twist knot and the four-twist knot, right, and the two-twist knot. Somehow you can't go from the other. So something has to happen. There's some obstruction, but it's some kind of non-local obstruction. Okay? So that's interesting to me. Another question is, what happens?
This is sort of what you're saying is the knots are more complicated than abelian fields.
Well, this is a knot in an abelian field.
Yeah, but you're not. If you have these three twists, you can't discard it.
Apparently, that's correct.
Also, don't you know that from the study of the topological invariance of knots that abelian fields are insufficient? What if you tried to fiber not abelian?
I don't know. Oh, I'm going to tell you about that now.
Because abelian fields don't get you very far.
Well, so I'm not talking about a gauge field, right? I'm just talking about a global scalar field.
When you talked about Maxwell, you were this one.
I know. I switched. Right? Now I'm just talking about a nice complex scalar. But let me add the following, right? Suppose instead, it's the next point, right? Instead of S1, so instead of having a complex scalar, like so, suppose instead I had a real pneumatic liquid crystal or a vector field, a magnet that could point in any direction. So if I have a magnet, then instead of the thing living on S1, it lives on S2. It's a unit vector. It lives somewhere on a sphere. Or if it's a pneumatic, it's a fancy sphere called RP2, right, which is half the sphere with diagonals identified, right? Opposite points identified, opposite poles identified. Well, Yannick showed that these support anything. You can have any kind of line defect you like, right? Pneumatics in particular, they enjoy line defects. Line defects that have charge 1/2 or charge -1/2. And the line defects in a pneumatic can do whatever they want. Right? So they are not constrained by this. So then here's a great question. What happens if you took a real pneumatic? And that, like I said, why knots now? Because people can do it. People can actually make knots in pneumatics. So suppose I had a knot living in a pneumatic. Here's a knot in the pneumatic. So if I have a knot living in the pneumatic, what happens if I apply a magnetic field? Which I can do. I apply a magnetic field, so I have I apply a field in the z direction. There are plenty of liquid crystals that instead of going along the field, want to lie perpendicular to the field. So when I apply a field this way, I have a transition from something that lives in RP2 to something that lives in RP1, which is the same as the circle. So I could have a knot that's allowed in a pneumatic, any knot's allowed in a pneumatic, put on a field, and boom, it's not allowed anymore. This is an experiment you can do, an experiment that you should do, okay? And for you, right? An experiment that should be done, because that would be cool. What happens to the illegal knots when you apply the field? How do they break up? Right? What are the rules? What are the combination rules? What do they spit out as you do that? So that's one of the other open questions. And I want to end with two more. Oh, good. Time is just right. I didn't get to tell you about the Hopf vibration. I want to end with a picture that's in a paper from 1986 that I think is really cool. I don't know how to spell his name. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that how he spelled it? Okay, close enough. So, here's the thing. If you have two rings, like so, these are linked. These are linked rings. Let's see, I need somebody who I don't know. Here, Chris. Okay. So, here are two rings. Can you hold the other ring? Okay, there you go. So watch this. You're watching? Okay. So, suppose that this ring carries a flux through it. So suppose when I go around this ring, I do a measurement. So this ring has some kind of magic current. Okay? So I make some measuring circle around this ring. When I measure it, I get alpha. Okay? I get some number, alpha, or some group element, alpha. And now I have another guy here. And I do some measurement around it. And I get some other element, beta. Okay? Now, in other words, I'm doing some calculation. I'm measuring some measurement of the fundamental group, pi 1. But pi 1, I keep saying it's a group, pi 1 of, it turns out, the biaxial monadic doesn't have to be an abelian group. It can be a more complicated group. It can be a non-abelian group. And that's why I said it was really exciting. In fact, it is a non-abelian group. It's very exciting that people can now make biaxial nematics, because here's a system where the fundamental group is non-abelian. So why is that interesting? Okay, thank you. Can you hold them higher? Okay, so watch this. I'm gonna be Marcus. I'm gonna do the path, right? So here, ready? Alpha, right? Beta inverse, right? They went it through the wrong way. You see how I went through the wrong way? Alpha inverse. Right? Beta. Look, they're linked. See how they're linked? But they're not linked in pairs. They're linked as a threesome. Right? These are called bromian rings, or bromian links. They're linked in, right? If you cut any one of them, they unlink. So what was the point of this? If you ask, what's the flux that goes around the blue curve? What is it? Anybody paying attention? No. I just calculated it. Alpha, beta, alpha, beta inverse, alpha inverse, beta. It's the commutator of those things. Right? Well, like I said, this could be a non-abelian group. In fact, it is. When it's a non-abelian group, it means that alpha and beta don't have to commute. And I just calculated alpha, inverse, beta. And if they don't commute, then there's actually a flux implied on this blue curve. The blue curve has a flux going around it too. These are actually linked topologically. If there's a field, if there's a biaxial nematic living around them, then these are actually topologically linked. Because if I try to undo it, I mess the fluxes up. The fluxes are all chosen consistently so that there are no tethers. If I try to move them apart, how should I say this? I'll draw a picture. We're back to my torus, like so. I like to draw the torus like this. You see, here's a torus, where I identify these two and these two. So the torus that this blue curve is the boundary of, right, has these group elements on it. You don't see that? Do you see it at all? Rob's asleep. Rob is asleep. Okay? Right? So here's this blue curve. Right? It's the boundary of this square. That's how I tie it all up. When I go around this blue curve, I've gone alpha, inverse, beta, inverse. What happens if it's not one? Anybody? I'll try you, Claire. No, so here's a rectangle. This is the surface of the torus. right, and I take this path, and when I go around this path, I don't get one. So it must mean there's a defect on the inside. So there must be a hole somewhere. So, what generally happens, this is a story, an old story too, that if you try to take two defects, and the group is not abelian, as you try to pull them apart, you force a defect on the surface of this torus. You force in a new defect that wasn't there before. But what's neat about the Borromean example is that there are no other defects. There's just three loops that are linked in this side. So in this trip, yes?
Why couldn't you do that with superfluid helium? Then you also have three Eulerian vectors and you can make...
Yes. Superfluid helium...
You only need biaxial magnetics.
But nobody can manipulate anything in superfluid helium. It's way too cold.
Okay. Mathematically, and these are mathematically.
Exactly, but I say why not now? Because you can actually manipulate liquid crystals this way. You can manipulate biaxial magnetics. You can put biaxial magnetics in a sample. You can buy biaxial pneumatics if you're friends with the right people, okay? You can buy them, and then you can put them in a sample, and you can put things inside, and you can actually manipulate the defects. I understand, all these things were pipe dreams before, right? When you read those old papers, the superfluid helium and superfluid helium A and superfluid helium B, and they have all these exotic order parameters, and Volovic writes these papers. Suppose you had a drop that was the size of the universe and it was filled with superfluid helium A, right? What would happen? Okay. So now we can actually do the experiments and find out, right? So I think that's kind of an exciting thing.
So these non-abelian.
Yeah. So, sorry. Yeah. So, a biaxial pneumatic lives in the space SU2 mod the unit quaternions. Look, this is a biaxial pneumatic. Okay. So it lives in the space of symmetries, objects that are invariant under rotations by pi around three different axes. So the full symmetry group is SO3, and I guess you mod out by the dihedral group, D2H, which is the same as this, right? So it's pi 1 of this, and that's just the quaternions. And so the cool thing is it's not abelian, they don't commute, and you can actually take a Borromean ring and you can put sigma x, rotations around x on this one, rotations around y on this one, and this one will have rotations around z. And all have minus one flux going through them. And these are truly linked because of the field around them. Right? They don't pass through each other because they're not just zeros. Even though they are zeros of the field, if you try to pull them apart, you'll get an extra defect. So does that answer your question? So I hope you come to some of our talks. There are going to be some really exciting ones. Today there's going to be one about actually how you do this, how you make knots in pneumatic liquid crystals. Knots to order, any knot you like. As long as it's what?
It might have to be fine.
No, not these ones. These are in a real pneumatic. You can get any knot you like up to what? Six crossings? Six? Up to six crossings. But that just...
Six is the limit of what has been done?
Yes, this is the limit of patience. There's no obstruction to seven crossings. Right? It's just what you can do. Sorry?
16.
They can do 16?
Why not?
No, they could. They're just, because there's a physics rule, right? Which is, people talk about glasses. They talk about glasses here. They've talked about this at the ITP for a long time, when it was still the ITP. Right? And they talk about glasses, and they have to say, how long do you have to wait to decide something's a glass? And the answer is 10 to the 8 seconds, right? Because that's 4 years, and that's how long a graduate student takes to graduate. So they cannot up to six crossings because it took 10 to the 8 seconds. Right, to do that. But, with faster graduate students, every year Moore's Law teaches us that the graduate students get twice as fast. And so eventually they'll be able to do any number of links. So thanks for your attention.
What about gravity?
money that is based on just 400 schools in Calpeca have ways of representing the field in terms of two sets of field markers.
Oh, yes. Well, so that's the part I skipped, right? Which is, you could also ask, what if instead of having the defects knotted, can you have the field lines knotted, right? And so that's the answer is yes. Yes, and you can do it in electric fields, with electric and magnetic fields. It was done here in Santa Barbara, actually. It was discussed in Santa Barbara. Right?
And this guy is working.
Okay, there you go. Right. So this is, let's say I practice this, so I should do this, right? So-called hot vibration, right? And so here's this texture in space where these are the lines. So there's a torus, and on the torus these things twist around and they're always linked with each other. And let's see, here's another one. Like so, and then these guys go this way. So and then there are lines and start coming like that. So you have this texture where you have these concentric tori and these concentric tori fill space, right? And on the tori, the directors or these lines, or the integral lines of the curves, or the field lines, these could be electric field lines, go around and they link each other. Okay? And this hot vibration is completely smooth. There are no singularities of the field, right? But this is also something you could imagine having in electric and magnetic fields. So you can have electric and magnetic fields, and then you have light that goes out. The light, and then it's like a light pulse that goes out. So you can have knotted light.
But my question concerned the gravitational field.
Well, I don't know about that.
You have these two sets of different field lines.
The gravitometric ones?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. But they're the same, right? It's just E and B.
They are the electric and magnetic parts of the Riemann tensor.
Right.
The integral curves.
Right. So in this case, you have an electric field. These are the lines of the electric field. There's another hot vibration, which is perpendicular to it, which is the lines of the magnetic field. And then there's a third hot vibration, which is perpendicular to both, which is the way that where the pointing vector goes out.
What do we learn once we know these facts?
Right? Now that you have it knotted? How do you go from one to the other? Suppose you have a knotted configuration like this, and you can do it in pneumatics too, where I have a speaker, an experimentalist coming in a few weeks who's going to talk about this, right? Suppose in a liquid crystal, you could have a hot vibration also. In fact, the very first observed hot vibration, I mean, it's hard to say. I guess you'd say Hopf discovered it, right, or predicted it, but then Yves Boulogne observed it in 1974 in this paper. He looks under cross polarizers, he looks at a pneumatic, and he sees these two linked rings. What are they? One is the pre-image of cross polarizers, one is the pre-image of north, and one's the pre-image of north-south, one's the pre-image of east-west, and they're linked together because all the lines are linked together. So now you can say, how do you go topologically? What do you do in a real physical system if you want to unlink those pre-images? Right, and so I know what happens, right? But the question is, do other people know what happens? And is that it's actually what happens in the experiment? Right, so you can now test these ideas, and you can use these to calculate, you can use these as a metric or a metrology for calculating the energy of the defects and how hard it is to put in defects. And you can also then ask yourself, can you engineer it? And the answer is yes. In the pneumatics, you can build them, you build them as you like to build them, by moving point defects around.
Randy, in high energy physics, Mr. Ed Witten got a Fields Medal for working on knots.
Not these.
So the question, why are...
I was told not to mention these.
Okay, so I mentioned them. Why are field theorists like Ed Witten interested in knots? Is it because of the Hopf vibration or entangled defect lines?
I think it wouldn't be appropriate here to discuss that. However,
discuss it.
However, you can talk on Friday. There'll be a talk about it. So what I know about is I know that you can talk about knots and you can classify knots and links using, right? So you can talk about the space of links. Radmila will jump up if I'm saying something wrong or too wrong. So imagine, here's my, you can call it the Hilbert space if you like, right? Here's the Hilbert space. Okay, there's nothing. There's one link. There's two links. There's three links. Four links, five links, right? Four circles, five circles, right? All these moves, all these knot moves. So what can I do? I can take these two guys and I can turn them into the hop link, whether it's linked like that. That still has two loops. So that's another state in the two circle sector, thank you, right? But I could take one of these guys and pinch it off and turn it into two. And then I have a transition from the two loop sector to the three loop sector and so forth. And so these are vector spaces. The most fancy thing, this Kovanov homology, right, is about turning these into vector spaces. So you have maps between different states in a vector space.
Yep.
Well, that's a field theory, right?
Okay.
I think the answer to your question is high-energy physicists are not interested in knots. They're interested in using techniques of high-energy physics to study knots.
Perfect. So this is one of them, right? So if you look at the space of knots.
So it's not the knots, but the mapping between these.
Yeah. Exactly. How do you join and disconnect the knots? Can you use this then to construct the knot tables or study the knot tables, for instance? That. Okay, thank you.
Well, quantum computation, which is interesting in knots.
That's right. You can also store information. But you can store information in knots classically. The Kipu did it, right?
I don't mean storing it classically. I mean knots at rate, which is
right.
Knots in 1 plus 2.
You said that the topology of knots and defect lines is in some sense protected by the field around them. But what protects the topology of knots in field lines?
This, knots in field lines? Oh, well, it's the coolest. Nothing. I can tell you what the answer is, right? The real answer is something, okay? The answer is that this thing, remember, we don't want to go to infinity, right? So this thing actually lives on the 3 sphere, right? And everywhere there's a direction in space, or every point in S3 has a direction associated with where the direction's going, right? The vector, okay? So it's a map from S3 to S2. Like so. But what's S3? S3, I don't know how to draw this, so I'm going to draw two of these reflections to remind you that this is a three-dimensional sphere bounding a four-dimensional ball, instead of usually what you think of as a two-dimensional sphere bounding a three-dimensional ball. Okay? So this surface, this is S3. This is the three-dimensional sphere bounding the four ball. Turns out there's a point defect in there. In the four ball, there's a point defect, okay? And that four ball contains this point defect, and it has a completely smooth texture on the outside, just like a hedgehog in a pneumatic where everything sticks out, has a perfectly smooth texture on the sphere here, even though there's a point defect on the inside. What protects it? The only way to change the charge is to pull this point defect through the surface, and then there'll be some horrible singularity that occurs when I do it. Right? I'll see a singularity. So I can't go smoothly from this to the one where it's unwound, because if I did, I can't. I can't go smoothly. The only way I can change the transition is by pointing this through and pulling it out. I think it's called an instanton. Does that make sense?
I mean, when I was about 10 years old, I saw a book where someone said, I take a floppy electromagnet.
You read about Derek's theorem and when you were 10?
I don't know. Not math. I mean, just take a floppy electromagnet and knot it. And then turn it on. So I take a coil.
Yeah.
Floppy, okay? I knot it.
Uh-huh.
Then I turn the current on, I get the connection. And then I unknot the coil line and they say, now I have the knot in the field, and I never believed that.
I don't know what you read. I didn't read that. Can you have a citation?
I think the question, is there an energy barrier? There is no barrier to go from here to an unmodeled.
Sure. Yeah. To do it, you have to, a nice way of doing it would be to create a hedgehog anti-hedgehog pair. So if you like, it's like vacuum breakdown, right? There's a field. The way I can go through it is by creating two defects, two point defects, and may they appear,
and then they move around and reinforce their
No. It's just like there's not an infinite barrier in a vacuum breakdown.
So how big is the barrier? What is it set by?
Is it set by the, that's what I was saying. The whole point is you can do this then to calculate the energy, the rest mass of these point defects. Right? You could, well, somebody has to do the experiment, but somebody can do the experiment.
This is a configuration of free Maxwell equation.
For instance, yeah. Or of a pneumatic. Pneumatic liquid crystals can do this. Well, that's the one I'm more comfortable with. I don't know how you do it. Do you know how?
If you're asking about the barrier to untying, it comes about, there is no energetic barrier. But you can see it as a constraint, which comes from electric and magnetic field. So you have a dynamical constraint. If E and B are orthogonal everywhere, the field is not, then the structure is preserved in time. And if you have areas where that is not true, then it cannot break. So it's not an energetic question, but there is a kinematic mechanism there. And that sets some serious constraints on what is possible, and one of the things which we're trying to figure out are what the rules
for this. When you were talking about knots in light, you were referring to the Hofstra version?
No, these are knots in the nodes.
This is black. There's different ways of thinking about knots in light, depending upon how you think of light. Light coming out of the end of the laser beam is very different from what they're doing with Maxwell field. Because you're worried about E and B and polarization and all that stuff. So there are different ways. Just like with thicker crystals, there are many different ways of looking at different sorts of fields. That's the same with electromagnetic fields.
So what is a node? I mean, is it E and B both zero?
No, just E.
Just E.
Yeah. This is really in scalar, you can do scalar on it.
It's where, if you have a laser beam,
it looks black. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why an ambitious atomic physicist couldn't make nodes and electron wave functions that were also knotted. It's a challenge.
Okay. Interesting questions to be answered. Thanks a lot.